Dick, what was it like growing up with Bert?
Tell the truth.
Now, keep in mind here, Dick is older than me. Let's put it this way. When he soloed at age 16, I had 5 years to go before I could do that.
Well, the thing is, when you're 5 years difference, see, we were never in the same school at the same time. We were never in high school at the same time, and so forth. He was always the little kid brother. And so, you know, that kind of relationship was not that much because of the separation of about 5 years. See, we had a sister, didn't we, in between then?
We still do. Still do, Dick, yeah. Name is Nell.
Her name is Nell. Yeah. Is Nell here tonight? I thought she was going to try to come.
Nell did not make it. I have not seen her.
Actually, Nell has more flying time than you and I both put together.
Oh, yeah, a lot more.
Of course, it's serving drinks in the back of a 707.
Yeah, our sister was a stewardess for some 27 years, I believe. American Airlines the whole time.
Yep. Yeah, I can tell you one little anecdote that I remember. I hope Bert doesn't remember it. 5 years apart. Now, my father, Pop, he built a little bedroom annex to the garage. And he had some bunk beds there, and they were all made out of pine, I remember that.
It was a woodshed before it was a bedroom, right?
Yeah, but anyway, it was kind of a nice little thing he fixed up. But our heads were together, and there was kind of a nightstand separation between them. So our heads, when we slept, were only about, I don't know, a couple, 3 feet apart. And Bert had a characteristic when he slept, and I'll ask Tanya if it's the same thing, but, you know, some people snore, but Bert had a thing that when he would breathe in or out, that something would close, and then when he'd breathe again, it would pop. And so that he would sit there, and every breath, there was a pop, and a pop, and a pop. And I remember
laying
there.
Wait a minute. None
there.
Of my wives have reported that. Are you sure that's right?
And I remember laying there trying like mad to go to sleep before the next popped. But then, you know, here I am, the older brother, and the little brother is popping and keeping me awake. So I think I got some cotton or some Kleenex or something and tried to stuff in his mouth.
It was a sock.
A sock? Oh, you do remember that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Dick, the other night when you were on stage here at Theater in the Woods, you told a little story about the difference between you and your brother, that one brother has certain characteristics and the other has others. Maybe you'd like to relate that tonight?
Well, you guys are ganging up on me, aren't you?
You know, in later years, you kind of reflect back about your character development and who you are and what you end up doing. And I think that our parents, when both of us were born, I guess when we were born initially, we had an average quotient of all the things that you have, any talents and stuff. So they thought that they needed to make it more unique. And so what they did, they took the academic prowess, of which I may have had some, and gave it all to Bert. And they took the sense of adventure that everybody has, and I think they gave that to me. And so I was kind of dumb, but I was an adventurist, and I'd ride motorcycles and stuff. And Bert had his slide rule and engineering, and he went off to college, and I went off to be a fighter pilot. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a good story, and I'll stick with it.
And when you're gone, I rode your motorcycle a lot more than you ever found out.
What?
I think the statute of limitations is up on that. So yeah.
we might find out a lot of new stuff tonight.
You know, about soloing, though, Bert, and I probably did a little of this, but you need to tell them about when you soloed and your friend, your high school friend, and you would...
Hutchison.
Yeah. You would sneak off to Sequoia.
Ronka Champ.
Yeah, sneak off to Sequoia Airport when you both were just solo
students. Wasn't Sequoia? I was trying to think of that, too. We were renting an airplane for $4.50 an hour wet. And I soloed it. And the next week, Gilbert Hutchison, my friend, soloed it. We both had the same instructor, who was the country western DJ, Johnny Banks, whose daughter I was really enamored by, but she never knew that. She turned out to be the first Miss Teen America, Darla Banks. And he charged us $2.50 an hour for instruction. So as soon as I soloed, wow, flying got a lot cheaper. And then as soon as Gilbert soloed, flying got even cheaper, because we would drive out to Alta Airport, where we flew. One of us would jump out of the 49 Ford and run to the airplane. And while he was doing the pre-flight, what the pre-flight was, the other guy would drive the 49 Ford through this rural area as fast as possible, heading to Sequoia Field. And whoever got there first, the airplane or the car, was the winner. But both of us were the winner, because Sequoia Field was deserted. And we both get in the Champ, and we were then flying for $2.25 an hour, wet.
That's both of you.
Yeah, we're both in the Champ. Now, the problem is, you guys remember when you're in high school, you might tell your high school buddy things that you didn't really do, like, I did a five-turn spin. The problem is, now you got him in the back or the front, and now you got to do it. And I remember also cutting toilet paper in that Champ over a high school football game. And you know, my dad didn't think that was unusual. And, you know, I didn't think it was unusual.
And the rest of the world?
Well, that was always amazing that we would do things, and we thought when we got caught, or when the local police would call our parents for whatever, or the farmers would call, that we'd be in a lot of trouble. But for some reason, we never got admonished for any of that stuff we did that I could remember. Now, when we acted up and were naughty kids, I can still remember the sound of a belt loop clearing. But as far as the adventure stuff and some of those outside things, I always wondered why I didn't get in a whole lot of trouble for a lot of that. It's kind of like freedom and liberty that we had a big quotient of.
And I think that's important to also recognize your parents, Mom and Pop Rutan. Very supportive of both of you throughout your careers, and really helped move both of you along, in fact, the entire family. So just want to pay them recognition as well, because they've certainly left us a great legacy. Thank you. So I'd like to jump forward a couple of years and, you know, move past the solo, double solo Champ, and move into, you know, the early, late 60s, when you started the construction on the Very Biggin, and the early 70s, and as Adam said, you know, really started a revolution in aviation. I cannot imagine what people were thinking when they saw you show up in 1972 in the Very Biggin. I've seen some film footage of it, and it seems like a very exciting time. And for those of you who may be relatively new to sport aviation and home building, I mean, this was, there, we see a lot of Very Easies and Canard aircraft out on the field today. It wasn't that way back in 1972.
Yeah. Well, I remember being enamored by aerodynamics that gave natural stall limiting when I was in college. And I rescued an old wind tunnel from college that had real thick dust on it. And I got it working, and I built a little model, and it was just three axis, lift, drag, and angle of attack. And I built a little model that looked a lot like the Very Biggin, and I found that, yes, it is feasible to make an airplane not stall, not have enough control power to stall the main wing, even though you were aft CG or forward CG. So I was enamored by that. And then later, when I worked at Edwards, one of my major programs was to see if we could improve the safety record of the F-4 Phantom, which had 61 losses due to stability and control, departure from control flight. Now, can you imagine nowadays if one type of fighter had 61 losses due to stability? Oh, that's right. You don't have that many F-22s, do we? But anyway, I got to ride in the back of these. I didn't get to fly. And I think the frustration by, I really want to fly, kind of made me try to build my own little fighter. And that's why I did the very big. And I wanted to also learn about natural stall limiting.
Thus, the canard configuration, configuration that became a Mercurtan hallmark.
The first flight of the airplane, that configuration is identical to how it's displayed in the museum today.
Now, the wind tunnel you talk about, is that the famous Dodge Dart wind tunnel?
No. This was one at college. The Dodge Dart was later, after I graduated from college, while I was developing the very Vigan.
So can you imagine that? Using a Dodge Dart to power your wind tunnel? No computers, no CAD, no. You're doing it all slide rule and.
Well, I was moving the model through the air rather than pumping air past the model, and I reasoned that might be smoother because you don't have wind tunnel wall effects. You know, you just kind of poke the, you know, that's how airplanes fly. They poke through air, and it seemed to me more natural to move the model through the air. And, you know, in those days, you could buy gasoline for 22 cents a gallon, so it wasn't really expensive to have it run a wind tunnel.
So, Mike, now you come into the picture in the very Vigan days. What was it like when you hooked up with Bert to create the very Vigan?
Well, I bought a set of plans from Bert. He sold them to me right out of the back seat of his very Vigan on the flight line for, I think it was $53. That seemed like an enormous sum.
27.
To me. And
what did you buy two sets?
And you know, I was foolish. I didn't realize that you really needed to spend a lot of money on the plans first, because you're going to spend a hell of a lot of money building the airplane. And so Sally and I picked up those plans. I went home and started building it. And Bert was an enormous help on the phone, through the mail. Email, of course, wasn't there. And we finally got the airplane built. And he had said that anybody who finished one right now could come out to Mojave and he would check them out in his own airplane. So we took him up on that, and we might have been the first people to do that, I don't know. And we went out there, and Bert put me in the back seat of his very big one and flew around, showed me all of its odd characteristics that it had. And then he put me in the front seat, and so I got a first-class training session with Bert, flying the airplane that I had just built but was too scared to fly. And when I went home, I flew it, and it flew exactly like his one. And later on, Sally and I flew out to the West Coast, and we stopped in at Mojave to say hi. And Bert took us out to lunch and offered me and Sally a job. So that's how it happened.
So you were the very first flight advisor then, weren't you?
Flight advisor?
Sure.
Well, what do you mean, the first?
Well, the EIA program of flight advisors.
I got it. Yeah. Well, it just seemed like a good thing to do at the time.
Now, Mike, you mentioned some odd characteristics. What was different about the very Vigan?
Well, the very Vigan had a very high thrust line, much like a lake amphibian or something. And if you got very slow on final and a guy pulled out in front of you and you applied full power abruptly, you were guaranteed to hit him, because it would pitch you down and you'd smack into the side of him. So Bert was careful to point that feature out and tell me to stay away from that area. And if you have to add power, add it slowly. You know, you have no prop blast over the elevator, and so you've got to build the speed. The opposite was also true. If you had a lot of power on trying to take off, you'd have the stick in your lap and the nose wheel was squashed flat because of the high thrust line. And if the runway was short, what you did was pull the power. If you forgot to push the stick forward, though, you would jump up into the air, and it wasn't a good idea. So he demonstrated that in flight, and probably saved my life, because several times those things happened, but what Bert had told me came back, and I said, okay, I'm not going to get into this area. But for all that, I put 800 hours on my airplane. We flew it safely all over the country. Everywhere we went, no one had ever seen one before, so we enjoyed the sort of thing Bert saw in the early days, all over again, because he and Carolyn flew all over the place. People said, wow, what the hell is this? And we had exactly the same reaction because no one had ever seen one. And that was really a lot of fun. But once more of them came along, it wasn't as much fun.
We both did barnstorming, didn't we?
We did barnstorming. And that was a ball. It really was. Learned an awful lot flying that airplane. It was a fun airplane to fly, but you had to be careful in a couple of areas.
Where did you go when you were barnstorming the airplanes?
I would go and circle little towns and do tight turns and do that for quite a while and then land at a local airport. And sure enough, people would go out there.
Can you imagine having never seen a Canard?
I didn't have a commercial pilot's license, so I won't tell you what I did when I went out there.
I don't believe that's in the research.
I think it is legal for two students to fly together. They've soloed, right?
Yeah, sure. I hope there's no FAA inspectors in the audience. Again, the statute of limitations is up on that one. But being here at Oshkosh, you're selling the plans. You know, we start moving a couple of years forward, 1975, it's the Very Easy, which is another sensation all over again. And this time, canard, pusher, but you're using composites for construction. Why did you settle on composite materials to build the airplane?
I didn't believe when I started building that Very Easy that that was something that was going to be suitable for the home builder to take bed sheets and honey and make that into primary structure to fly. But I had hot-wired foam cores for model airplanes back in high school. And the fiberglass work that I had done was fun, and I felt that this could actually make safe structure. I did a lot of static testing of subcomponents. Like I made the joint between the wing and the vertical fin, and I loaded it up with sandbags and so on, and to see how strong it was. The thing that surprised me in building the original Very Easy was that it went dramatically fast, the construction, compared to the Very Biggin. I'd spent something like 4.5 years building the Very Biggin, and it took me 3.5 months to build the Very Easy. Another thing that surprised me is I came to an observation, which later proved to be right, and that was it's more immune to workmanship problems causing structural danger. If you weld steel together in a fuselage, for example, and you put a bad weld almost anywhere, the fuselage can break. And not everybody welds very well. If you bend aluminum too tight and rivet it, it can crack there. And I found that I believed that the average person with a little training was more likely to build adequate structure than a steel or wood or an aluminum airplane. And to supplant that, my wife and I did a lot of traveling. We went many places over the United States, to EAA chapters and so on, and demonstrated these methods to, 100 people at a time, maybe 200. I went to France, England, Netherlands, Germany, New Zealand, Australia, a bunch of other places, and brought along suitcases of materials and actually had workshops. Now, this is after we started selling plans for the Very Easy, and I had become from a poor, struggling guy selling cheap, Very Biggin plans to now I was super rich because we were selling a lot of Very Easy plans. It was interesting. I brought one suitcase along with my clothes and another one with the building materials. And as you guys that build these airplanes, one of the building materials is white microballoons in plastic bags. And during all that travel internationally, several times they asked me to open a suitcase, and it was always the one that had the clothes in it.
That's a very good thing. Doug, did you have something you wanted to jump
Yeah, on? I think anybody that's built a composite airplane will agree with me when I actually suspect that Bert simply has a sanding fetish.